How do we creatively and wisely engage and relate to people, especially people who seem far away from the gospel? You know, Paul said, I don't want to preach the gospel where it's already been preached. I want to break new ground. I want to go new places. And so I've made that a passion in my life to try to bring Christianity into secular settings or into non-religious or non-Christian religious settings. And I want to win arguments with unbelievers, but I want to do it in a gracious, caring way.
This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast equipping you to defend your faith. Here's your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
From the 5th century AD is preserved to us the remarkable tale of the valiant Beowulf, prince of the wind-loving Geats, who does battle with hideous emissaries of the underworld, including a dragon. It is a spellbinding tale of bravery in the face of overwhelming and seemingly impossible circumstances that would melt the hearts and shake the knees of most of us. The following is a selection from J.R.R. Tolkien's early 20th century translation of Beowulf, where the hero goes up into the lair of the dreaded dragon serpent to face him head on. Quote, "Then the bold warrior stood up beside his shield, resolute beneath his helm. Wearing his grim mail, he strode up to the stony cliffs, trusting in the strength of one man alone. Such is no craven's feat. Then he who, endowed with manly virtue, had passed through many a host of battles and a clash of war, when the ranks of men smote together, saw now at the mound's side a stone arch standing from whence a stream came hurrying from the hill. The boiling water of that spring was hot with deadly fires. No man could long while endure unscorched that deep place, nigh the hoard by reason of the dragon's flame. Now in his wrath, the prince of the wind-loving Geats let words speed from his breast. Grim of heart, he shouted loud so that his voice came ringing clear as a war cry in beneath the hoary rock. Hatred was aroused. The guardian of the hoard perceived the voice of man. No longer was there space for the suing of peace. Forth came first the blast of the fierce destroyer from out of the rock, hot vapor threatening battle. The earth rang. The Lord of the Geats beneath the mound flung round his warrior's shield to meet the dreadful comer. Now was the heart of the coiling beast stirred to come out to fight." End quote. I found a great deal of inspiration from Beowulf to be able to face my own personal dragons, whether it be a fear of man, a fear of death and dying, or just a wide assortment of other irrational fears. Beowulf offers much inspiration for all of us to be courageous in such perilous times. For many of us, dragons can be the mental perceptions and concepts we create for ourselves, things that prevent us from truly seeing and experiencing our faith in Christ as it was meant to be lived out. Consider, for example, what C.S. Lewis once wrote about his inspiration for writing the Chronicles of Narnia. Quote, "I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ. I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings, and reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if it were something medical. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them, for the first time, appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. End quote. In Narnia itself, one of the characters, Eustace Scrub, encounters a dragon, but has little knowledge of dragons and thus falls prey to one of its serpentine enchantments, the hoarding of wealth and possessions. Eustace finds, to his dismay, he has become a dragon and must be undragoned by Aslan, king of Narnia and son of the emperor beyond the sea. And consider the memorable exchange in Tolkien's The Hobbit between the hobbit Bilbo Baggins and the nefarious serpentine wraith of Lonely Mountain, Smaug. Bilbo, Tolkien shares, quote, was not so unlearned in dragon lore, end quote, and in order to buy time and preserve himself alive, conversed in clever riddle-like fashion with the dragon. Quote, if Smaug hoped to get him to come nearer so easily, he was disappointed. No, thank you, O Smaug the Tremendous, he replied. I did not come for presents. I only wished to have a look at you and see if you were truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them. Do you now? Said the dragon, somewhat flattered, even though he did not believe a word of it. Truly, songs and tales fall utterly short of the reality, O Smaug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities, replied Bilbo. You have nice manners for a thief and a liar, said the dragon. You seem familiar with my name, but I don't seem to remember smelling you before. Who are you? Where do you come from, may I ask? You may indeed. I come from under the hill. And under the hills and over the hills my paths led, and through the air I am he that walks unseen. So I can well believe, said Smaug, but that is hardly your usual name. I am the clue finder, the web cutter, the stinging fly. I was chosen for the lucky number. Lovely titles, sneered the dragon, but lucky numbers don't always come off. I am he that buries his friends alive and drowns them and draws them alive again from the water. I came from the end of a bag, but no bag went over me. These don't sound so creditable, scoffed Smaug. I am the friend of bears and the guest of eagles. I am ring winner and luck wearer, and I am barrel rider, went on Bilbo, beginning to be pleased with his riddling. That's better, said Smaug. But don't let your imagination run away with you. This, of course, is the way to talk to dragons. If you don't want to reveal your proper name, which is wise, and don't want to infuriate them by a flat refusal, which is also very wise. No dragon can resist the fascinating of riddling talk and of wasting time trying to understand it. There was a lot here that Smaug did not understand at all. Though I expect you do, since you know all about Bilbo's adventures to which he was referring, but he thought he understood enough, and he chuckled in his wicked inside. End quote. Eventually, Bilbo maintained his wits and tricked the dragon into revealing a weak spot in his armored scales. Quote, I might have guessed it, said Bilbo. Truly, there can nowhere be found the equal of Lord Smaug the Impenetrable. What magnificence to possess a waistcoat of fine diamonds. Yes, it is rare and wonderful indeed, said Smaug, absurdly pleased. He did not know that the hobbit had already caught a glimpse of his peculiar undercovering on his previous visit, and was itching for a closer view for reasons of his own. The dragon rolled over. Look, he said. What do you say to that? Dazzlingly marvelous, perfect, flawless, staggering, exclaimed Bilbo aloud. But what he thought inside was, old fool, why, there is such a large patch in the hollow of his left breast as bare as a snail out of his shell, end quote. So what has any of this fantasy storytelling to do with apologetics, you might ask? Well, it is a storytelling sort of reminder that we finally are not engaged in warfare with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers, rulers of darkness in the heavenly places, who are observant of man and his ways, and who are bent on our destruction, who tempt and try our minds, deceiving us, turning us away from the truth in hopes of destroying us. But we are called to take up the full armor of God and resist the devil and Satan, the dragon of old, who seeks to devour and destroy us. The battle begins in the mind. How do we wrestle the dragons and emerge victorious? With wisdom and strength, not of this world. On part two of our discussion with Professor of Philosophy at Denver Seminary, Doug Groteis, we discuss how to recognize the tools and arguments, how to engage non-believers with civility and compassion, recognizing that our non-Christian friends are finally not the ultimate source of our conflicts. Jesus calls us to present our bodies as living sacrifices, to renew our minds, to resist the devil, and to love our neighbors and enemies alike. Doug's 2010 book, Christian Apologetics, is an edifying tome that can encourage and strengthen us to glorify God in all that we do, 1 Corinthians 10:31. It provides a comprehensive perspective of the Christian worldview, offering insights and experiences from Doug's years of engaging students and individuals in professional and academic settings, both secular and Christian.
One of the aspects of Christ's atoning work is reconciliation between people. That came to me with real force. I was reading Colossians, and Paul says that he died in order to break down the barrier between Jew and of course, that breaks down ultimately all barriers, as you see in Galatians 3, 26 through 28. In Christ, there's neither male nor female, slave nor free, that kind of thing. So, when you look at something like the civil rights movement in the United States, the approach of Martin Luther King, you can see it's all based on the gospel. It's based on the cross. And King also called forth the greatness of American ideals. He didn't say abolish America. He wasn't burning any flags. He wasn't destroying anything. If you read the I Have a Dream speech, which in reread, he appeals to America's greatness. He says we have to hold true to our founding ideals that all men are created equal.
That so, seems to be lost today in what we're dealing with. The equality of human beings before our Creator.
Right.
I mean, it seems like that Paul, what Paul's talking about, breaking down the barrier, breaking down the divisions between Greeks and Jews, and you know, Gentiles and Jews, and that I think that's important, because a lot of times apologetics with the big picture in mind, we tend to think broadly in terms of the cosmos or biology or science. And I like what you say, really, it begins with being reconciled to your neighbor. It begins with that reconciliation between that individual and Jesus, or you and another individual, or just engagement one-on-one. It's like David Wood and Nabil Qureshi.
Right.
That long-standing, years-long engagement and dialogue and commitment to one another individually. And you look what Nabil did in his time. And so it's that patient cultivation of relationship in person and long-suffering, as Jesus says, right? The patient cultivation, long-suffering, being able to build a relational trust with somebody. All of these things are why Jesus came in the flesh, I would think, to emphasize that incarnate participatory mm-hmm. aspect of our being.
Exactly. And I really commend a book by Oz Guinness. He's been such a tremendous influence on me for over 40 years. He has a book called Fool's Talk, and it's about reclaiming the art of persuasion as Christians. He doesn't give a lot of apologetic arguments. That's not the point of the book. The point is, how do we creatively and wisely engage and relate to people, especially people who seem far away from the gospel? Mm. You know, Paul said, I don't want to preach the gospel where it's already been preached. I want to break new ground. I want to go new places. Mm-hmm. And so I've made that a passion in my life to try to bring Christianity into secular settings or into non-religious or non-Christian religious settings. So you will learn a tremendous amount about how to wisely engage people and how to use humor and ask good questions. Also, there's Greg Kokel's classic book, Tactics, mm-hmm. which just came out in a second edition about a year ago. I think those are the two best books out there on what you might call the rhetoric of apologetics or means of on the street interaction with people. They're terrific. And I'm hoping to incorporate some of those ideas into the second edition of Christian Apologetics. Although I do talk about the centrality and the cruciality of the character of the apologist and the prayerfulness of mm-hmm. the apologist. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of developing good arguments. It is. And I want to win arguments with unbelievers, but I want to do it in a gracious, caring way.
Right.
And I want to do it in such a way that people don't grit their teeth and say, yeah, you were right. But the people delight in it. They delight.
They're like, oh, yeah, I see that.
I see that. I see the argument. I see Christ.
A pastor of mine years ago when I was a new Christian had said something that has always stuck with me. When you want to win someone, when you're engaged in an argument, I can't remember exactly, but it was like, if you want to engage an argument, be sure you do so in such a way as if you win the argument, that person wants to continue to talk to you.
Exactly.
That to me would be
It's not like being in a debate.
Right.
It's like, it's not like being in a debate and you thrash the other person and they run away with their tail between their legs.
Right. They want to come up to you and talk to you afterwards. But of course, the proclamation of gospel truth isn't always going to make friends with people. In our culture of still relative openness and freedom, we still have the benefit of civility. Among us still, I mean, for the time, it seems to be narrowing, but it seems to be still like a possibility to be cogent and wise and winsome with people. Doug, speak a little bit about how you think, you know, whatever your two cents is. You didn't get into it in the book that much, but I wonder now with the advent of, you know, with the lockdown and the advent of social media, here we are on Zoom having this chat with Facebook, Twitter, YouTube especially. What is some wisdom for how to use social media wisely in apologetic engagements? Because a lot of it I see, I'm on Twitter a little bit, I watch YouTube videos, there's a lot of snark and ridicule and unnecessary. I mean, if you have a relationship with someone and you want to banter a little bit and be a little snarky with somebody that you know and trust, that's one thing, but it just seems like there is a lot of snippety kind of vitriolic snarking and that kind of thing that you see in social media. What would you recommend? How do we as Christians wisely negotiate the use of social media in our apologetics?
That's an important question, and it's not really easy to answer. I was concerned about the advent of the internet a long time ago. I wrote a book years ago called The Soul in Cyberspace, which at the last count, I think 7 people had read. But this was even before the advent of social media and cell phones. So I've been concerned about the philosophy of technology. And the first thing is go back to Marshall McLuhan, the media theorist.
Right.
Who had a background actually in rhetoric. He said the medium is the message. What he meant was that every medium shapes the message and every medium will affect how the message is communicated strongly. So if I'm sitting down over coffee with someone and we talk about the gospel or we talk about politics, we're probably not going to start insulting each other and shouting at each other and
yes,
and making faces at each other, you know, putting GIFs up there, GIFs.
Right.
But when we're on Facebook, it's extremely easy. All I have to do is type it out, press the send button, and off it goes. So we need to realize the limits and then also the benefits. The benefits for apologetics would be reaching many people you could not talk to one-on-one. And that's true, obviously, for what we're doing here and for radio. But then something's missing.
Yeah.
And all of us with the corona problem are just missing face-to-face group situations. Mm-hmm. It's tough. Mm-hmm. So we've had to make the best of the second best. I finished up teaching my classes last term at Denver Seminary on Zoom. Mm. And I'm really happy I have a job and I continue to teach what I think is important and benefits people. But it's limited. It's a medium, but it's also a buffer.
Right.
You are not in the same room with everybody. Everybody's in their own room, and it's mediated through a screen. A lot of our life is now mediated by three screens, the TV, the phone, and the computer.
Yeah.
And we also spend a huge amount of our time in our cars. And how does that affect our communication and how we communicate the Christian message? So I'm learning. Let me tell you something that my son-in-law told me that was really helpful, my new wife, Kathleen's son. He said, it might be wise to save your political comments for Twitter and just do more of your ministry and personal interaction on Facebook. Mm. And my wife, Kathleen, endorsed that wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. So I've decided to do that because I have political views and I want to communicate them, but I don't want them to foul up my apologetic message.
Yeah.
And it's probably better. I think Twitter is less interactive and Facebook is more relational. I post short essays. I posted one recently about the nature of America for Independence Day. And I put apologetics up there. You know, when this goes online, I'll put a link to this page. So I'm still working on it myself. And I certainly do not always succeed at all. I think the basic message is restraint, thoughtfulness, prayerfulness, and then also periodically just taking a break.
Right, right, right.
There's a book called The TechWise Family, and the author says that abstinence is helpful. Like you might say, there are a few hours in the day when you don't go online, or maybe one day a week where you take one week a year. Or maybe you take a vacation and you decide not to use it at all. So you have more time to think, reflect, pray, and it can become a real distraction. And sometimes it can bring out the worst of us. It has done that with me, certainly.
Yeah, I am mostly on Twitter. I started on Twitter to promote our book, The Story of the Cosmos, that came out last July, and with Paul Gould. And I didn't intend to stay on Twitter. It was like a promotional tool. But then I ended up staying on Twitter and making some Twitter friends and enjoyed it. But then I learned so much about the medium and, well, what's the proper way to negotiate this particular medium? Because as you say, Marshall McLuhan and then, of course, Neil Postman.
Yeah.
The kind of technologies that we use become the message themselves, and they shape the kind of engagement that we are. It shapes the dialogue when we use a TV or we use the computer or whatever. It shapes the dialogue, but there is a way to fashion it, as you say, to such an extent to wisely interact with it and recognize, okay, here's where I'm weak, here's where I'm strong, here's where this is a positive, here's where it's a negative. But to be able to rationally sit down prayerfully, wisely, negotiate, limit the time spent on there. And I find that there are certain things I won't talk about on Twitter, but I like to promote our podcasts. I like to talk about the book. I like to share scripture, but I don't respond to the GIFs. I don't respond to the nastiness that does come. And I always say hi to people on Twitter. If I don't know somebody, I'm like, hi, Mark, how are you? Nice to tweet you, you know,
right.
Which is
greetings.
Greetings. Yes. Greetings. Hi, how are you? Yeah. Hope you're doing well.
Very significant theologically.
Right. Yeah. But I think that's important because there's generally no greetings in cyberspace.
You
say, hi, Bob, how are you doing today? Hey, was thinking of you, blah, blah, blah. because you only have 240 characters. But I think it does speak to the importance of the incarnation, Doug. I really do think that God in a body is no small statement, and that what he ultimately requires of us is the kind of ministry that is done incarnationally. And it seems like, you know, we could go into a whole nother discussion about this, but I've been thinking and listening to, I don't know if you know Ken Myers in the Mars Hill Audio Journal. Ken's had some guests on there that have talked about in greater detail and depth the authority of science, and you look at the cultural ramifications of scientific authority in our culture, and look what it's done to us. It is it portends to be for the body, but really the kind of authority in science today is anti-incarnational. Separate, bind yourself, remove yourself. You know, we're taking the dictates of what it means to be human and how to interact as human beings from a materialistic scientific authority. And you look at the resultant fruits of this: suicide, anger, hatred, violence. You know, the church seems to be divided on this issue of masks. But a lot of this, I mean, Ken traces it back to the kind of cultural authority that we've assumed without thinking about it. And, you know, Christianity is inherently, it has always been countercultural, and it has always been the most effective when we are in the body ministering. That's why Jesus says, what, go, right? And make disciples in the person. You go like I came, and you come like I went. You go in the body, and you live in the body, and you proclaim in the body. How do you see that going forward in the kind of culture that we're engaged with right now, where it seems like we can't be with each other?
Well, I agree with everything you said. It was really well said and well thought out. I think of the end, some people might just read over this too quickly, the end of 2 John and 3 John, where the apostle says, I would write more, but I long to be with you, that our joy would be complete. So he's writing Holy Scripture, but he says, there's something missing. I'm not with you. So we really need a theology of embodied presence. And here we are in a time where we're supposed to keep our distance. And I went to church for the first time in 4 months yesterday, and I didn't hug anybody. I didn't even hug, didn't even shake hands with anybody.
Wow.
Because we were advised not to. And I agree with that, given the health situation. So we need to be prudent. We don't want to endanger anyone else unnecessarily, endanger ourselves. But we have to, at this time, develop a theology of the second best. So teaching out my classes on Zoom is better than having the class canceled. So I want to do that the best I can. But I don't want the second best to usurp the best.
Right, right.
So as soon as it's safe and healthy, then I want to be back in the classroom. I want to be back on secular campuses presenting the Christian message and handling questions and talking to people afterwards. And I desperately yearn for that. But right now, we're in a second best situation, and we're really having to cope with a diminished life. I've been noticing in myself recently, you talked about some of your struggles with depression. I've had that a bit over my life, and I realized in the last 4 months, I don't think I'm clinically depressed, but I think this general sense of malaise I feel, like, you know, I haven't been in a classroom to teach in 4 months, and haven't been able to preach a sermon, haven't been able to go to a coffee shop, a friend, or talk to an acquaintance who's not a Christian. So we just go back to Christ and pray, hope, do everything we can, because all the essential facts are still the same. God is God. The cross is there. The Holy Spirit is with us. The Bible has a mission. We have a mandate. Not a Christian. So we just go back to Christ and pray, hope, do everything we can, because all the essential facts are still the same. God is God. The cross is there. The Holy Spirit is with us. The Bible has a mission. We have a mandate. So we make the most of it.
you know, in some degree, to some extent, Doug, I think that, you know, you look at the methodological authority of science, scientific method, the sort of this kind of pragmatic methodology is sort of the kind of god of the age. It's like, how do I make salmon? How do I fix my car? How do I mean, there's nothing wrong with these practical questions, but they finally are sort of the intellectually, epistemologically, the idea is if I have the right method, then I will obtain that which I seek, whether it's knowledge of God or how to fix my car or, you know, what's going on Jupiter. If I have the right method, I can apprehend the truth. But then that method supersedes whatever you might discover about reality in general. It seems like we are a methodologically rooted epistemological pragmatism, I think, or methodological pragmatism, if that's a thing, to where even in apologetic dialogues, I think to some degree we take on the very vapors of secular materialism when we set up our arguments, almost to some extent. Do you think there's a kind of, do you think that the secular, the way the secular mentality is today, that impedes upon apologetics, how we present it? Or have we ceded too much in terms of how we frame the discussions about Jesus today, do you think?
Well, it can. And I think of this idea of functional rationality, that there's a set way to achieve certain goals. So the example that's often used is McDonald's. Of course, McDonald's is wildly successful to be reproduced anywhere. There's a very simple model for what a McDonald's is.
Right.
And if you want quick food, that's the place to go.
Yeah.
If you want fine cuisine, that's not the place to go. So you have to understand what it is you're bringing about through it. And I think there is a kind of quantitative reductionism afoot in our society, wanting to measure things that are very difficult to measure. Mm-hmm. For example, intelligence. Now, intelligence can be measured by IQ, and I think it gives a somewhat reliable report. Still reductionistic, because your intelligence may be strong in one area and very weak in other areas. Even personality tests can be reductionistic. And sometimes you'll talk to someone and they'll say, well, you're a 3.7 PQR or something you're talking about. I'm Doug Grotheis. So we need to be careful in reducing people to quantitative categories. And then also in evangelism and apologetics, we can get tips and principles and stories that will help us tremendously. But there's no divine algorithm for bringing people to Christ. There's one gospel message, certainly. But as Oz Guinness says in Fool's Talk, Jesus always interacted with people in the moment, and he never interacted with two people exactly in the same way.
Right.
So we need to, in a sense, exegete the situation that we're in and ask questions and then listen.
I just spoke with Ryan Putman. You know Ryan?
Yes, I do.
He and I just had a conversation about his new book, and he said something to me that, you know, you know is there, but when he said it, it crystallized that Paul did not leave the church with a set of instructions on how to have a diaconal meeting or how to set up church government, or, you know, that right. his epistles are kind of devoid of the what we're speaking of here, this methodological approach to the how-to that we're so accustomed to. I mean, there's nothing, you know, how do I make salmon is a purely practical and innocent question, but we forget that it's not finally about method. The scriptures seem to be, I mean, Jesus was very generic in terms of, well, Lord, how do we go about making disciples? You know, he doesn't give us the syllabus or the schematic and what we can expect in 6 months. It's very open-ended, and it seems to be, according to just what you said, that we adjust fire based on where we are, based on who we're talking to. And this requires a great deal of creativity and ingenuity and of course wisdom from God, there's no one size fits all method, right?
I agree.
Do you think that apologetics, when we talk about apologetics as a catch all umbrella term, do you see that as a methodological? Does method come to mind in the minds of most people when you think of apologetics, or is this kind of more of a, you know, how do we disengage the idea that apologetic is a kind of method versus something that is a gospel proclamation? In other words, do you think there's a distinction there?
Right. Well, I think there are two mistakes. One would be to spend all of your time developing your apologetic method and then not do apologetics.
Right.
And I have very little patience for that, apologists who just write for other apologists. But on the other hand, you could just be kind of scattershot and irresponsibly eclectic in how you engage in apologetics. So what I teach my students is you should work out a method of apologetics. My method is called the cumulative case approach.
Yeah.
But then having those arguments in your mind, use them appropriately in whatever situation you're in. So you have actually a schema for how a total apologetic would work, but you don't say, okay, sit down and listen to me for an hour while I give a summary of Christian apologetics by Doug Grotheis. What you do is you listen, however edifying that would be. You listen to their questions. You try to discern their worldview. Are they agnostic? Are they atheist? Are they theist without Christ? Are they Muslim? Do they have a combination of New Age and Christian beliefs? Try to figure that out. Get to know them. Be kind, loving, personable. And then you use the knowledge and the method that you have in the moment, in that situation. So on the one hand, apologetics method is extremely skint. You should work one out. And chapter 3 of my book gives my cumulative case approach. But then you apply it in a very flexible, creative, spirit-led kind of way. And people that don't hold exactly to my method or don't hold to my method at all can still be successful in apologetics. And let me give you a quote. Dwight L. Moody was once the great evangelist, American evangelist, was asked or was challenged by someone else concerning Moody's method of evangelism.
Yeah, I love this.
And Moody said, you may be right, but I like my way of doing evangelism better than not doing evangelism. So you may not like my apologetic, but I like my doing of apologetics better than you only writing about it, to sound a little feisty here.
Right, right. I like what I'm doing compared to what you're not doing. Some sense. Yeah. Right. So because I see that, if somebody's, I don't know how anybody in the church could be unfamiliar with apologetics. Everybody's probably heard of it, but I think a lot of people think it's just some sort of intellectual icing that this unnecessary baggage that you just layer on top of the gospel, and it gets in the way of the gospel because it involves a lot of intellectual arguments people don't have time for, et cetera, et cetera. But I think a lot of that, Doug, comes from what you say in the beginning of your book about the nature and the character and the way in which apologetics is presented, not just to atheists, but to the church, to your pastor, to your fellow congregants. Are you the guy who thinks that apologetics is going to solve every problem, and you know your pastor doesn't know anything because he doesn't know anything about apologetics? Or do you winsomely present it? So it's not just a matter of winsomely presenting it to atheists or unbelievers or Muslims or Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever. It seems to be, this is equally necessary in terms of presenting it to your church. I would think that there's that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's something that the great countercult apologist Walter Martin used to say, and he was such an influence on me. He would say the church is like a sleeping giant. Mm. So when we awaken to the discipline and the requirement of doing apologetics, it's not a suggestion. Peter tells us to be ready to defend our faith and to defend it with gentleness and respect, 1 Peter 3:15. We see Jesus as an apologist, as a philosopher. When Christians see Jesus was an apologist, Paul was an apologist. You see that everywhere, but you see it in Acts 17, where he's at Athens, a great center of classical philosophy, then people can get motivated. So when I speak in churches or other Christian settings about apologetics, I give an apologetic for apologetics. And it's all based on the Bible and on the need to minister to the questions people are really asking. So you need to understand something about the thought forms of our culture. And mentor in this, I never met him, was Francis Schaeffer. In fact, the last couple of days, I just reread Escape from Reason. I think it's about the sixth time I've read it.
Mm.
And I may disagree with Schaeffer on a few points of philosophical interpretation, but the man's passion for the lost and his willingness to think well with the non-Christian and to show where non-Christian thought leads, which is ultimately to despair and hopelessness, is commendable. And I'm always motivated. I'm always inspired to do more, to reach unbelievers for Christ when I read Francis Schaeffer. And I encourage people today, read The God Who Is There. He is there. He is not silent. Escape from Reason. Some of the examples he gives may seem dated. You might disagree with a few matters here and there, but he will really open up your mind and your heart to the significance of apologetics in honoring God and reaching lost.
Absolutely.
Reaching the lost, because apologetics should always be linked to evangelism, if at all possible.
It's kind of one and the same. I've always kind of seen it as, well, certainly intrinsically bound together, like Jesus is God and man. You speak of Schaeffer on page 84 in your book, from his 1972 book, Genesis in Space and Time. And you have a block quote from him. He says that the universe had a personal beginning on the high order of the Trinity. That is, before, in the beginning, the personal was already there. Love and thought and communication existed prior to the creation of the heavens and the earth. Now that's Schaeffer, and then you go on to say, so from the biblical worldview, there is nothing deeper than personal love. That is the foundation of the universe. And it's very Dantean, right? I think Dantean was an excellent apologist, at least in this regard, because, you know, he knew it was love that moved the sun and other stars.
Right.
And I think a lot of the way in which, you know, modern science and cosmology sort of attacks the universe and demanding answers from it is kind of like your wife coming home, or you coming home with roses for your wife, and she rushes off to the lab and crushes them and looks at them under the microscope and tries to pick apart their constituent elements, which, okay, that's fine, but she kind of misses the point of the roses in the terms of the, as an expression of love. And there's nothing wrong with chemical analysis of flowers, but it's not primary in terms of why the flower at all. How did she come into possession of the flower? Well, it was your act of love that brought them into the existence of your household. And it seems to me that is exactly where science has gone, you know, wrong in terms of missing the whole, you know, in a materialistic universe, there's no teleology to the universe.
Right.
Looks purposeful, but that's illusory, right?
Yeah, I think it was Francis Crick who said that biologists have to keep telling themselves that even though biology seems to show design, it really doesn't.
Yeah.
So I have a little notepad next to your microscope. Say, no design, no design.
Right.
Intuitively, you see the design, you recognize the design, but somehow because you're a scientist, you're not supposed to accept it.
Right.
And there's a very profound illustration of this. I show it to my classes often. There was an astronomer named Robert Jastrow, and he wrote this tremendous book called God and the Astronomers. It came out in the late 1970s. And Jastrow was interviewed. You can see this on YouTube. It was in an Illustra media video called Privileged Planet, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, I'm in a dilemma, which I'll never escape from. He said, as a scientist, I see the world as materialistic, but I also see evidence of a design. And he said, I will never solve this problem, because he felt like as a scientist, he couldn't accept design, but he saw design.
Yeah.
And sadly, Robert Jastrow passed away a few years after that. It's really compelling because he sees the evidence, but a false view of science, that is, science is materialism, kept him from recognizing what was truly there.
Right. Richard Dawkins echoes this. He says, he's said several times, I've seen in print in both lecture, he says that, you know, the universe, biology exhibits the illusion of design. And so the best that people can come up with is though is this idea that design looks illusory, but then that betrays one's innate sense perception that no, this is not illusory. This is exactly what we've been designed to see, is that God has clearly revealed himself in nature and that man suppresses that truth in unrighteousness. And this is, I think, exactly what Paul is saying, that if you come out and say, boy, it sure looks designed, but you know, I got to keep reminding myself it's only an illusion. And I think that's probably the greatest myth of our time, is people trying to repeat this narrative over and over again, that though everything inside of us screams design, everything in the universe screams beauty and glory, that we just suppress it all as meaningless, accidental, and purposeless. And I think that's the tragedy of our age. I think that's why we are suffering so badly, is that if we're accidents or if we're not intended to be here, as Carl Sagan said back in the 80s in Cosmos, it doesn't look like anyone's coming to save us from ourselves, you know? And you would ask, why would Carl Sagan talk about a savior, the need for us to be saved from ourselves? You know, he was an advocate of making people aware of the dangers of the nuclear warheads. And he thought at some point, maybe if we don't reverse our course, we're going to destroy ourselves. But, you know, he was acutely aware of this problem with the propensity within human beings to destroy themselves, but offered no solution except that we are children of the cosmos. Right. We're made of star stuff, but that doesn't save you or help you or encourage you in any way to behave a certain way to your neighbors.
Yeah, that's what Oz Guinness in The Dust of Death called mystification. You try to find significance in something that doesn't really have significance. Or Schaefer talked about semantic mysticism, that you use a word that only has real meaning on a Christian understanding of reality, but use it as an atheist or a pantheist, but it doesn't have that meaning. So you get this sense of reverence for the cosmos as some sacred thing in Carl Sagan or some other. But where do you get the concept of sacred?
Right.
If the universe is just particles. Mm-hmm. You know, Philip Johnson used to say the materialist story is in the beginning were the particles, and then 14 billion years later, according to fortuitous laws, here we are.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the biblical story is in the beginning was the Word.
Right.
And the Word was with God, and the Word created all things, the Logos. So the universe holds together because of the Logos. We can discover truths about the universe because of the Logos. We have moral intuitions that can be reliable because of the Logos. And the materialist worldview is no Logos,
right.
Period.
Right.
I mean, logic just emerges out of nothing, and consciousness emerges out of nothing on the materialist view of things.
But as you quote T.S. Eliot, quote, humankind cannot bear very much reality. And it seems that this is kind of our predicament as fallen creatures. Apart from Christ, we can't bear much. We can't, without his grace and mercy and regenerative spirit, we are going to hide our face from the Lamb of God. We are going to denigrate his kingship and his lordship. It's interesting. I was reading Paul Davies, the secular physicist, not long ago.
Right.
He has a quote that he's very explicit. He's like, look, modern cosmology has, I'm paraphrasing here, he's like, you know, it's like physicists have went to a churchyard sale and bought all the ecclesiastical vocabulary that they could for a cut rate. You know, here's $5 for eternity and $2 for this term and for that term. But if you look at the physics and the cosmology and the language that's used to describe it, I mean, you have physicists making eternality, making energy eternal. talking about a singularity and laws that govern. And Paul Davies is put off by this. He's like, look, I don't like this monotheistic language, but here it is, and it's distinctively monotheistic in nature. I suggest we have a paradigm shift in our vocabulary because it's too godlike, right? But when you boil it down to it, Doug, it seems like that's the only language that is even remotely applicable to describing the nature of the universe coming into being. It's godlike in essence.
Right.
Our vocabulary inescapably shows that, I think. Do you agree?
Well, often these materialists will deny theism, meaning they deny creation by a personal being. They deny teleology, providence. They deny any kind of rectification of the evils of the universe. But then, maybe even unconsciously, they revert back to those themes and those yearnings.
Mm.
And that speaks of the human condition. That speaks to the fact that, you know, to use Pascal's language, we're deposed royalty. We're great in the universe. We know something about being part of a larger story, but we're fallen and we're in need of what Schaeffer called an infinite reference point beyond ourselves to bring all the different particular things into a larger meaning.
Yeah.
I think of Schaeffer in one of his books referring to Francis Crick, who after a while in this book started capitalizing nature and she to refer to nature. Wait a minute, what are you capitalizing nature for? It's almost like a ersatz surrogate deity here. Nature knows this, nature does that.
Right.
And then you also often find Darwinists talking about evolution designing things.
Yes.
And on their view, Evolution Institute, it can't design a darn thing.
No, it's I often say to people, and when I get into these discussions, isn't it a curious fact that if natural selection being the impersonal mechanistic agent of the cosmos or biological life anyway, turns out to be what reality is all about, that she or natural selection bequeathed to us a language that can only describe her as though she or it was a being, you know? Mm. So how odd that our evolutionary vocabulary has only left us with the option of describing nature as though there's intelligence behind it. But of course, to this day, there is no thoroughgoing natural selection theory of the development of language, which is really interesting. No. You know.
Yeah, and that's an aspect I didn't deal with in the first edition of Christian Apologetics, and I'm already adding so many things, but there's a profound argument there.
Yeah.
You know, the argument from language. You got atheists like Noam Chomsky who would admit this. He's saying that Darwinism cannot explain the acquisition and use of language, but somehow it has to be true because there's no God.
Right. I got that quote from Tom Wolfe, the late author of I think the right stuff, but he cites the theory of the paper in his book of which Chomsky is a part. So Chomsky was involved in this peer-reviewed formal philosophical scientific paper about the evolutionary development of language. And the conclusion of the paper is we have no idea. And of course I can hear an atheist say, well, this is a God of the gaps argument, but still when you take it into a collective successive evidences that you provide for a theistic worldview, language is but another aspect, not just one by itself, but it certainly is a powerful one for why does our language, even if mathematics, why does 2 plus 2, something that we allegedly just evolutionary, just developed here on this little pale blue dot of a planet, why does 2 plus 2 work on Jupiter? Why does it work on the moon? Why does it work for Andromeda? Why does it work for the rest of the universe? How does our little finger counting account for the stars in the universe? Why is there a correlation? That's bizarre. And for a materialist.
And some naturalists admit that. Like you probably know famous essay, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, where the author, I'll think of his name in a minute, I hope. He's an atheist and he says, it is amazing. It is actually unreasonable that mathematical thoughts in these little human brains can map out onto the cosmos effectively.
Mm.
The unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Only unreasonable on the atheistic worldview.
Right.
Utterly reasonable on the theistic worldview. It's not a problem. You know, it's something that we can explain.
Right.
So when the naturalists say, oh, a theistic explanation is always God of the gaps. No, what it is, if it's done well, is an inference to the best explanation.
Yeah.
We'll play fair. We're not begging any questions. Saying that you can explain a whole lot in the world according to material causes and effects. We're not denying that in the slightest. But there are some facts, actually every fact, but there are aspects of reality like human language and the fine-tuning of the universe that are better explained beginning God created the heavens and the earth than in the beginning were the particles.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking to an atheist a couple weeks ago on YouTube. He asked me to be on his channel. And his idea was that language is just something we made up. And I sort of retorted with, well, isn't it weird that if we've just made up language, that it has such resonance in being able to describe what we discover about the physical universe, the correlation and the correspondence of our language mm-hmm. to the rest of the world as we know it. You couldn't have science without language, the laws of logic. But, you know, in a naturalistic worldview, you can't explain language or the laws of logic as coming from just a random arrangement of matter and energy. That's a very difficult chain that has a lot of missing links in it. But as you say, if we begin with the word, that our God is a word God, a logos, logos in the flesh, that the proclamation of the universe's origin comes through verbal speech, as best that Genesis describes it to us, though anthropomorphically, mm-hmm. that God is speaking these things into existence. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think it was the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge that believed things like stars and the things in the physical universe were like a kind of divine speech that pointed beyond themselves. Just like the word star points us to the actual star, the star points us beyond itself mm-hmm. to something else, which is the glory of God. And so the physical world is sort of...
Well, that's Psalm 19.
The physical world...
The heavens declare, and it's a kind of speech that's referred to. It's not... the star giving us sentences, but it's the stars and the planets and all the configurations of the heavens revealing or disclosing that they are the result of a divine author and artist.
Yeah, absolutely. They are creation is a translucent declaration of the glory of God. Even the skeptics have the eyes to see it, but they call it, you know, illusory, you know, which is tragic because then as an individual, your intelligence, what looks to be like intelligent statements, axiomatic statements, declarations of truth, that everything that's coming out of your mind and mouth is an illusion. Because in physics, according to the way things are arranged, matter is mostly empty space. And so we have to finally, in the end, admit that if our intelligence is anything, it's the result of a random collocation of atoms, as Bertrand Russell said. Mostly empty space proclaiming mostly nothing about mostly nothing.
Some atheists are realizing that this account of reality does not explain things at all. So instead of becoming theists, they become panpsychics they hold a panpsychism. And I think you see that with Thomas Nagel, his book Mind and Cosmos.
Yeah.
And there's another book out I haven't read yet called Galileo's Error. So what they're doing is instead of saying in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God and all things were created through him, what they're saying was, well, mind and intelligence and logic and morality are just there.
Brute facts.
In fact, the body is consciousness. That's it.
Right.
But the consciousness is not the consciousness of a personal being that created and designed and holds all things together. It's just consciousness now becomes a brute fact as opposed to matter becoming a brute fact.
Right.
And you've advanced exactly nothing in your explanation world.
Right, right. And I mean, if the brute fact metaphor were to prevail, there's really fundamentally no reason for doing science anymore because we're arriving at dead ends and brute facts. We don't want to investigate. We don't want to ask why. We're just going to grant the quark. We're just going to grant the singularity, and we're going to stop asking questions about why that's there. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like a science killer. You're not advancing anything. You're killing off.
Yeah, it's a knowledge stopper.
It is. It is.
If you don't allow design into your scientific explanations, and there is design, then that principle is a knowledge stopper and ultimately a science stopper.
Right, right.
I just thought of an interaction I had with an atheist philosopher named Bradley Montan. He used to teach at University of Colorado in Boulder. And he surprisingly came out with a book called Seeking God in Science. And he said that there was good evidence for intelligent design. We need to take it seriously, and philosophers need to stop poo-pooing it and dismissing it. Now, Brad remained an atheist, what was this, 10, 12 years ago. Hmm. And he was talking about the difference between an atheistic and a theistic understanding of the universe. And he said, theists believe that at some level everything can be explained and everything is purposeful. But the atheist account of the universe is that a lot of things can't be explained. And so I asked a question. I said, Dr. Montan, are you saying the best explanation for much of the universe is that there's no explanation for it?
Mm.
I wasn't trying to be a smart aleck.
No.
But it just struck me that's what he was saying. And it wasn't a gotcha kind of thing. I really wanted to see what he would say. And
right.
His response was not very good, because there is no way to respond to that.
Mm-mm. You have, I've encountered this many times, where you meet the ardent skeptic who says, pretty much emphatically at the outset of the conversation, well, there's God doesn't exist. We're pretty confident that God doesn't exist. You know, maybe, but we're pretty confident that God doesn't exist. And then you start asking these poignant, deeper questions about meaning and purpose and teleology and ontology and epistemology. And it's one after the other, Doug, of I don't know, we don't know, I don't know, mm-hmm. we don't know, I don't know. Right. And then you get back to the original statement, well, then, how can you be so sure that God does not exist? So, you know, right. there's this emphatic flag planting up front. But mm-hmm. when you start peeling back the layers of that hill, you realize there's really nothing underneath that but a hard agnosticism, or maybe even a hard solipsism.
Well, and also skepticism should not be the default position. You know, you need to earn your skepticism. Hmm. So the hardcore skeptic who says no one can know anything, well, first of all, that's self-refuting, because you're claiming you know that no one can know anything. But then if someone says, well, no one can know anything about God, I mean, maybe there's a God, maybe there isn't, nobody could ever know. I'd say that is a strong universal claim about every single knower in the universe.
Absolutely.
About the most compelling concept in the history of the human race, God. Now tell me exactly why we could never know whether or not God exists. What are your reasons for this? Mm. You don't just win by going to the default of skepticism.
Right.
You need to justify your skepticism.
Right.
Now, in some matters, you can. But just having it be the default for everything, or having it be sort of the guiding principle that we don't know anything, is not very wise at all.
No, no. And so for the Christian, I mean, I know people have, I don't particularly hold to one particular apologetic method or another, but I generally find when you get into the deeper philosophical assumptions about epistemology, how we know what we know, it is for me so comforting to be able to trace it to the source, who is the logos of all my truth and wisdom and knowledge. As Paul says to the Athenians, in him we live and move and have our being, and in him all things cohere, all things hold together, that, mm-hmm. you know, I can maintain my sanity, even though when I'm suffering, to know that the difference between me and someone who doesn't know Jesus is that I know who I know. I know my Redeemer lives. I know he has declared and has proclaimed and has sustained and continues to grant me the wisdom and the knowledge and the perseverance and the strength and the grace mm-hmm. and the humility to persevere. And it just seems to me so utterly reasonable that knowledge and wisdom mm-hmm. and truth and logic and light and love, it all has a source mm-hmm. in a person, in terms of personhood, as we speak of the divine being, but in the person of the Logos, the risen Lord Jesus Christ. He is the central, he's the Alpha and the Omega, the bright and morning star, the star of David, the star of Jacob, a sun and shield. He is the source of everything. And I think, thank you for your book, Doug. It was a wonderful, refreshing reminder to me that there's nothing like Christianity for, in terms of explanatory scale and scope, for how you can bring so many different things, seemingly disparate and different things, together in one cohesive worldview. That seems to be the one of the greatest powers that we have as Christians, is this cohesive worldview that can answer these difficult questions.
Right.
So a great book. I know it's you got a second edition coming out. When is that going to hit the shelves?
I don't really know, because okay. I'm still working on it, and I'm working on a really long in-depth on the atonement. I've got a chapter in defense of the church.
Okay.
And I'm going to be adding some other material. So I'm not really sure. I'm hoping 2021, that would be apt, because that would be a 10th anniversary edition.
Great.
But those who are listening who believe in God and believe in prayer can certainly pray for me. We'll
Amen.
Get this done and make it a better work.
Do you yeah. have a website or a way in which people can follow your work? Are you just at Denver, or what's some good stuff for you to follow up
yeah.
for people to follow up with?
Mm-hmm. I've got a web page where I have an active blog and lots of links to lectures and interviews and so on in my books. It's simply called douglasgrotheis.com.
Okay.
I am on Twitter, and I have a, what are they called? Public figure Facebook page.
Okay.
I have a personal page that's usually kind of maxed out, but then there's a, whatever it's called, public figure page on Facebook that has unlimited people who can be friends. So you could follow some things there too.
All right. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Doug, and, for your ministry and for your faithfulness and perseverance and what you do at Denver and for writing. I love the book. Again, I thought it was very readable. You know, sometimes you get into these academic books, they can be quite dry, but this one really moved along with warm and friendly prose, is what I would call it. It really Good. Keeps you in the text and keeps you going and keeps you through it. And it was very cohesive. I mean, it was great. I'm glad I was able to persevere through it. You say Good. Toward the end that you're like, you weren't sure if you were ever going to finish the book.
Right.
And I underlined it and I said the same thing. I was like, I didn't know if I was ever going to get to the end of this either. But a great book. Don't let the size of it daunt you. Douglas Grotheis, Christian Apologetics, A Comprehensive Case for Biblical Faith. Thank you, Doug, for joining us on Apologetics Profile today. It was great.
Well, you're welcome.
This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today.